This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Petri dish, noun. A small, shallow dish of thin glass or plastic with a loose cover used especially for cultures in bacteriology. Petrie was an assistant to the eminent bacteriologist Robert Koch. In 1887, Petrie introduced a vessel for growing bacteria that consisted of two round rim plates, one serving as a cover for the other. Petri dish. You're listening to the Petri dish on Joy 94.9, and today we have a little show for you. And by little, we're talking about insects. I was going for it. We've got big little ideas.
And little but mighty.
Little but mighty. Mighty M-I-T-E.
I'm pretty sure they outnumber us in population, and we actually haven't identified all insects on the planet as well.
And they definitely outnumber us in population. And legs as well. They have many of them.
They're very interesting creatures, and we're going to tell you all about flies. Where do they go during winter?
That's right. That's our myth, that they disappear during winter. I'll remember this scientific fact is we're going to tell you what exactly is an insect.
A controversy, insecticides. What do they really make an environmental impact?
Exactly. And our movie for today is, could we have giant superhuman bugs? Not superhuman, but just giant insects that kill us all.
That movie Starship Troopers scared me a lot. Don't kill me. He's going to join us for 9 with a Petri dish. And Wendy, you can tell us some insect, maybe a bug story? Bug's life, sorry.
Oh, you totally took my pun, because obviously insecticide news is not a pun. I was going to say, I don't mean to bug you, but you've already used the word bug. It just doesn't matter. Stinging news is our first. Research published today from Deakin University has uncovered an important step in the life cycle of malaria that could bring new therapies to prevent the spread of this disease. The malaria parasite grows inside red blood cells, but to survive and actually cause illness, it has to transport or move proteins to the outside of the blood cells. Now, these proteins are crucial for the parasite to survive, and researchers from Deakin, from good old Melbourne, have found that all of these proteins, in order to get outside of the blood cell, they use the same pore in the skin of the blood cell. They all have to sort of exit through the same highway. So if we could block this,
the highway, then
the highway, exactly,
the malaria cars can't get out.
Exactly. Now, there are 400 million cases of malaria each year, with about 1 million people, mainly children, dying from the disease. So this is mighty exciting research, and it was published in the hoity-toity scientific journal Nature. So that's exciting insect news. Well, the malaria is spread by mozzies. I thought mozzies are insects.
It's sort of relevant.
It's passing through. Eye of the Beholder is our next piece of research of science news. International scientists have built an artificial eye based on the eye of insects. The eye, made of perspex globe with silver cones, could be used to guide robot vehicles, aircraft, and even used in surveillance. So what makes insects' eyes so special is that they can see all around, like a panoramic. And so these special eyes that are based on the way that their eyes work have 360-degree all-round view and uninterrupted.
Wow. Be like a real transformer bug.
Exactly. So that's kind of exciting. Silky sex is our next piece of news. In April this year, scientists from CSIRO revealed the sex life of silkworms. Well, a small portion of it anyway. Don't get too excited,
well,
kids.
Silky soft.
Oh dear. While researching how insects smell as part of a project, actually, to create a handheld biosensor device for detecting odours in wine. So they were looking at insects to help us uncover good wines or to help us research good
wines. And they took on, they discovered the mating patterns of silkworms?
Well, they looked at the genome of the genes and DNA in silkworms, and they found that there's this particular odour receptor, so almost like a smelling device, that only women would make. And they thought, what's going on here? Why are only the female of the species making this device? And then they found out that the males make a pheromone that gets attracted to this female sensor. So
I thought like the silkworms were smelling the wine and they got a bit frisky. Those crazy worms.
And on target with this one, our final science news segment is called Love Bugs. And although this was published last year, it's interesting and it's from the University of Melbourne and it's about bugs. So suck it up. It's not so much science news, but science old. Anyway, they found that agricultural environments encourage insects to reproduce without having sex. So I actually should have called it non-love bugs or non-loving.
Non-touching love bugs.
When insects have a stable environment with a lot of resources like grain crops or orchards, vineyards, plantations, they were four times more likely to reproduce without sex compared to other insects.
So bugs can produce with sex and without sex.
Many insects are asexual, so which is a bizarre word to describe them because they can actually reproduce without sex.
That's so strange, bizarre. So the more food they have, the more so they're being satisfied by food and not they don't need to have sex.
They don't need to have sex, but then theory goes that only dolphins and humans enjoy sex. So.
I mean, there was a bit of bug fun going on in the crops, in the daisy fields.
But there's no love fun. It's everyone, the bugs are masturbating, it seems. No, I've gone too far. I'm terribly sorry. You're listening to The Petri Dish on Joy 94.9, and today we're talking about insects, little bugs, little grubs. And for our myth right now, we're going to be talking about Shane is going to tell us where flies go when it's winter because they're flying around all the time. You know, bothering us. Who knows why? Who knows where they go? And I've actually wondered this. So, Shane, tell me, where are the flies going?
The flies aren't going anywhere.
What?
They're not disappearing at all. It's an outrage.
What? But they're everywhere in summer.
I know. Well, let's go through a bit of fly biology.
Excellent. Fly by night.
So, let's talk about the fly's life cycle. So, a fly's life cycle is similar to that of a butterfly's life cycle. So, you've got the egg. Think of the caterpillar, think of the cocoon, and the butterfly. So, a fly's life cycle is kind of similar, but a little bit more different.
A fly has a little caterpillar. Is that what a maggot is?
Oh, no. A maggot is a worm. Not a caterpillar, but the maggot. I guess kind of the same intermediate phase. So, the female flies lay hundreds of eggs, which then hatch between 8 to 24 hours later. So, it's quite a quick hatching period. The larvae then feed and grow, which takes about another 4 to 10 days. And during this phase, they move from somewhere that's really moist to somewhere that's like really moist, like manure, onto a bit more dry ground. And the larvae begin to take on traits of the adult fly during this development. So unlike the caterpillar, where it just stays as a caterpillar until it's ready to go in a cocoon, and that's where the metamorphosis takes place. In a fly, in the larvae, they begin to slowly start taking on some traits of the fly. As he gets older.
Oh, excellent. So, little bug starts growing up. Fly.
So, just to finalize the maturation to a fly, there's the cocoon phase, which takes about 3 to 5 days to form. And then after a few days, a fly emerges the cocoon and the fly is ready to start breeding again.
I love that your voice just was like this beautiful, magical experience between a fly and a maggot and a larva.
It is a beautiful experience between a fly and a maggot.
And some moist manure. Right, so but that's quite a short period. That's not all of winter that we have this process for.
It's not all of... It's just mainly during summer. So, now, a really interesting thing about... the really interesting thing about flies is that they require temperature to breed. So, let's say the female house flies, its ovulation is actually determined by the temperature. If the temperature falls from 20 degrees and below, a female's ability to produce, it goes into diapause, which just temporarily stops ovulation. So, it doesn't produce any eggs, as many eggs.
So, when the fly's on heat, it's ovulating?
Or? Yes.
Right.
When it's actually hot and it's on heat. I just got that. And if the temperature drops below 6 degrees, it goes into complete diapause. So, that means it doesn't produce any eggs whatsoever.
Right.
Now, if it's laid eggs in between this time... Only when it starts reaching to 20 degrees and above will the eggs start to hatch.
Okay. So, we've still got flies. They're just not... So, they're dying out. Because what's the lifespan of a fly?
15 to 30 days. So, it's quite short. So, they have to keep breeding. And obviously, there's one fly that can survive during winter, say, in an office building. Like, here at Joy, it's pretty warm. So, there could be a fly nest somewhere that we don't even know about. Because most flies, you know, breed where they are born as well. They don't really fly that far out from where they began.
So what is bringing them back every summer is just the few flies that are surviving.
Yeah.
And then the weather heats up.
And if the eggs have survived, then they keep. And because the weather's always warm during summer, you see a lot of flies. And if you notice that, you know, this summer's quite. So it wasn't that warm. We didn't have that many flies. But as soon as the temperature skyrocketed, we had many fruit flies, house flies. We had so many flies everywhere.
Wow. So they're not just flying off to warmer climates and then...
No. They tend to hang around, like, if they were to exist, say, in country Victoria with farms, they exist around manure because it's really warm as well, and around the animals, and they're really warm. And so they just need warmth to survive. And if it's not warm, then the maggots don't really survive as well. And if they do manage to survive, then those ones will then reproduce as well.
So that's our popular myth today. Busted is what we've got there. I always thought that the flies fly off somewhere warm, which makes sense that they wouldn't. They couldn't get that far.
But interestingly enough, like, researchers have found that they could do it, but they don't, because they like staying close to where they were born.
Ah, so they're home bugs.
The home bugs. They're not too sure about that yet, but there's definitely, they don't fly that far out from where they actually came from.
Wow. So this is a hot topic we have here.
Yeah. Flies. Who knew? So interesting.
Bryce Creswell is not so impressed. He sent us an SMS that says, "What is going on? Moist flies? What? You guys are wrong." But we are right.
We are right.
Tells you.
Flies like to, you know, be in moist manure. What is an insect?
What is
an those lovely things I used to love to eat? I mean,
not used to. Well, insects are arthropods, which is great, because we all know what an arthropod is not. All right. They are, when you're talking about what is anything, it's all about classification. So there's people who love classification. They look at a new animal, a new creature, a new plant, and the only way that we can fit it into a box, or that we feel like we can study it and compare it to other things, is we have this certain criteria for classification. So an arthropod is something with a hard external skeleton. So humans have an internal skeleton and insects have an external one, and it protects their soft internal organs. They also have segmented bodies, like in flies. Flies aren't a great example, but of course they are insects, so they do. But ants are a good example, or centipedes and things like that. And they also have at least three pairs of jointed legs. So no insect actually has more than three pairs of legs, except for some immature forms of caterpillars that have little things called prolegs. And these are appendages that serve the same purpose of legs, but they're not actually legs. So therefore, classification still stands.
But then they're called prolegs.
Well, that's right, because anytime you classify anything, it's all just a human game of we want to put things into boxes.
Now, this is the most ancient science, by the way. The Linnaeus system has not changed since the 1870s. Just a bit of trivia there for you.
Whoa. Fine, you want to take over this segment?
No, go back. Go.
No,
go.
But that's quite interesting. But it does show how long humans have been obsessed with classifying life on.
I'll give you more trivia at the end of it.
Oh, I'm intrigued now. Insects also have one pair of antennae that is located on their head. And most insects have one or two pairs of wings, although some, such as lice and fleas, are completely wingless. So there is a huge array of the insects. The main things are the exoskeleton and the segmented body. But what is interesting about arthropods and insects in general is that insects are the most successful arthropods on the planet. So there are far more species in the class of Insecta than any other group. So arthropods. Other arthropods include Crustacea, which are crabs, arachnids, which include spiders.
So spiders aren't insects.
Spiders are not insects, that's right.
And what makes a difference? Why aren't they insects?
It's just more classification. So suppose they've
there's a Linnaean system of classification.
exactly. And Insecta are sort of under the umbrella of the arthropod, but on a different leg. And it's thought that insects are the most successful because they can fly and colonize new habits easily. So they've conquered all environments on Earth except for the frozen polar environments at the highest altitudes and the immediate vicinity of an active volcano.
Ooh, they're highly adaptable creatures, aren't they?
They really are. And that's huge.
That's huge because there's no really other animal that can adapt to so many environments. And you can find, you know, ants no matter where you are in the world. You can find flies no matter where you are in the world.
Exactly.
Except, obviously, the frozen regions.
And they have a very important role in the great circle of life. You might just think, shoo fly, don't bother me. But they pollinate flowering plants and they assist in the decomposition of plants and animals. So the precious flies.
Flies and bees and spiders aren't insects, but...
I know. We've all learned something today. But these classifications are all funny. But that is what an insecta is.
Wow.
You got any more trivia for me?
Well, you know, the classification system, it's the oldest science ever. It hasn't been changed since Linnaeus first introduced it in 1870. Yet scientists aren't still happy with the way it's done.
And yet they're not changing it.
Because it's a very, like, archaic method. They base it on things like sex and non-sex. It's very complicated if you go into the Linnaean system. And it's actually really not perfect because it's just like, I think this trait belongs to this and so therefore it is. So it's not complete. But with genetics, it's a bit different now because we can...
That's right. I mean, so you would think that we would create a new classification model now that we do have genetics. Because even the idea of like an exoskeleton and an internal skeleton, sometimes it's not so black and white with the new animals, and we keep finding new creatures that we don't know where to fit them in. And
it's just getting a bit ridiculous. Every time they find a new species, in the past they used, you know, a Latin word to kind of describe what it is, and now they just call it by the person who discovered it. So if I discovered it, it'd be called... Shanus Wunus, the insect. Everyone enjoy.
Dreams will be dreams.
I will discover an insect one day and name it after myself. There we go. There's some classification trivia. It's not a perfect system, but they still haven't changed it. It's from 1870 onwards.
That's right. And now you know what an insect is. You're listening to The Petri Dish on Joy 94.9, and we're telling you all about bugs, grubs, and other insects. Right now, our controversy is pesticides. Are they really destroying the planet? Shane, tell me all about it.
Let me have a bit of a cough first. All those insecticides are making me cough. So insecticides started using them in the 50s. So this technology has been around since the 1950s. Along with fertilizers, the development of fertilizers, they led to the Green Revolution, where crops were artificially enriched to produce massive crops. And this actually led us to feed another 2 billion people on Earth to sustain two billion more people.
So pesticides and fertilizers combined have allowed us to produce so many more agricultural goods that we can feed 2 billion people.
Yeah, because, you know, insects are a very big problem. They can reproduce really fast, and if they get out of control on a farm, then they can just destroy a whole entire crop. Whereas with the aid of insecticides, these chemicals, if we spray them, they can kill most of the insects. Well, the insects that are susceptible to the insecticide will die out. But there's also a problem with insects being resistant as well. So, if we remember from our Darwin and our genetics that we talked about a few weeks ago, there's always genetic variation, and we've produced an artificial selector for insects, which is insecticide. And so, the insects that survive and become resistant, survive and reproduce. And then that generation produce an even... another generation become even more resistant to that insecticide. And so, we've got to keep producing more and more toxic insecticide.
Right. And so, that's where we're up to now, 50 years of generations of these bugs that have very small lifespans, which means they're reproducing quite quickly, giving a lot of room for resistance and for genetic pressure.
Exactly. And so, because, you know, things like DDT, which is a very common insecticide, being used, it's definitely more toxic than what it was in the 50s to keep up with this resistance that the insects are developing.
And so is this causing damage to us, to our environment?
Well, yes, because if you also go back to high school and talk about the food chain, remember, you know, insects are a very vital part of it, and birds eat it, and it actually, those insects, they die from it, and then the birds will eat that, and they will also get sick from it and die from it if they eat enough insects as well. Because DDT doesn't kill you immediately. It's a slow build-up of the toxin. And that's also a problem as well, that it doesn't kill them immediately. It takes a while to kill them.
So, for the bugs that have not become resistant. So, we've got one problem that we're getting stronger and stronger, or more and more toxic pesticides. And another problem is that we're buggering up the circle of buggering up. Oh, God. the circle of life. Because for those who aren't getting resistant, animals are eating them, and then they're dying out.
Exactly. Now, the real problem is that if we got rid of insecticides, about 3 billion people on Earth will starve to death.
Like.
So, that's a really... So, that is a real, real, like, dilemma. And, you know, we may be saying, like, let's switch to organic pesticides, but they're just as bad as synthetic ones in terms of their effects and the effects on, you know, the food web and on the insects as well.
What is an organic pesticide? It sounds like a great marketing ploy, but ultimately it's still something that is
killing off animals. I think it's something that's not artificially produced and it comes from a natural product like a plant.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's being produced and that even is so toxic that it also can kill.
Well, that's right, because the whole purpose of an insecticide is that it's going to kill the insects, whether it comes from a chemical or it comes from a plant. Seems like it would have that same reaction of perhaps like it wouldn't have such a negative effect on birds that are eating the organic pesticides. However, it would still cause resistance and we'd still need to make more and more toxic.
Yeah, and those and somehow eventually those organic insecticides will have to be modified to become stronger as well.
Exactly.
So, how do we solve this problem? How do we look at this? And the best way really is to look at how... Probably the way the bugs behave. Because, you know, insecticides pretty much was a quick fix answer, which is kind of like an error of the human race is that we kind of just try to fix problems really quickly without really looking at the solution properly, like the problem properly.
Right. Well, the problem is ultimately humans need to eat and we like to eat lots.
And how do we stop the insects from eating our food? We're being outnumbered. So, there's things like preventative measures. So, before... So, the University of... Scientists at the University of Melbourne have developed a scoring system based on which pesticides are being used and how often. So, you do this before you spray your crops.
Mm-hmm.
And if your score is high, is above a certain number, you know that you'd be harming your environment. If you can find a number of techniques with scores below that number, you can try them and find out which works best for you.
Something like netting. Is that what they're comparing whether you use pesticides versus like a net? Is that the idea?
Yeah, or like the various techniques you use and how harmful that would be to the environment. So, the preventative measure. So, you analyze that before and then if your number is below this number.
Right.
Then you can is the best way and you can try all these different options to fight these pests.
And has this been adopted worldwide or is it just an idea that's come up recently?
It's kind of being adopted, but, you know, every ecosystem kind of behaves differently. There's no set model of an ecosystem.
Of course.
And so, this is kind of a bit hard to quantify, really, and use and implement.
And so, have these pesticides been dangerous to humans as well? There's a lot of talk that that's why we're more allergic to things that people... We hear about peanut allergies, food allergies so much more often, and people are saying it's because of the pesticides. Is there any evidence for that?
Not that I found a research, I didn't go down that path, but you know, that also the more having more allergies and being more allergic also has to do with the hygiene hypothesis, which is we're becoming too clean and we're not being exposed to enough dirt and dust as kids.
Mm-hmm.
Could you think about it? We so go on a antibacteria, you know, your mum's as soon as the baby's born, we clean everything when really they need to go play in the dirt, eat those bugs and get those, you know, get sick to improve their immune system and improve, you know.
We keep killing off the bugs with the pesticide. It's trouble.
But DDT, you know, if that's on the crop and we didn't wash our fruits and vegetables properly and if we ate enough of it, yes, it will be toxic to us. It is also, I'm not too sure on this. I think it also may have some cancer links to it, but nearly every chemical does these days.
Right.
So, DDT obviously is very dangerous. Now, another way to do it, another solution is you can create pest refuges, like a refugee camp for pests. And basically, that means you create a separate crop specific that you don't spray with insecticide specifically for these bugs.
So, they'll all go over there
instead
of to where you want them to
go. That's the theory. But the problem with that is that we need to find the land to grow another extra, you know, just grow extra crops for these bugs to eat.
Does that actually work? I can imagine that the resistant bugs would just sort of be thinking, woohoo, no more competition.
Yeah.
I'm heading to the place we don't want them to go. It's a cute idea, though. They'd all be attracted to each other.
So, you know, it's not really that great. Now, something that's even a little bit better is that scientists have found is to kind of understand the genetics of the insects and find out what gene causes resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And so, they found a gene. And so, they're trying out new drugs that are developed to specifically attack this gene. So, we can create drugs that are genetic, that gene-specific.
So instead of pesticides to kill the genes, we're just trying to prevent resistance.
Yeah, prevent resistance. And so we still need to use both in combination. So we need to use the drug that stops the resistance and also still the insecticide so the insects are susceptible.
So now we're using two chemicals instead of one really strong chemical.
Yeah.
Four of six.
Four. That's
2 times 2 of the other.
And the final one is a bit more environmentally friendly, is genetic modification of our vegetables and fruits. And this is being used in cauliflower and cotton at the moment. And an insecticide called the BT toxin is expressed in the plant. And when the pests eat the plant, it kills them. It only affects the insects and not the animals that eat it. So this toxin is specific to
the insects.
Exactly.
But I imagine that would be difficult to market because at the moment you're saying that we have toxic producing fruit.
But this is not this BT toxin because of the way that our digestive tract is very different to that of the bugs and pests and the pests that eat cauliflower.
Mm-hmm.
It's only harmful to them but not to us.
Oh, wow. That does seem like a great solution.
Yeah, and this is being developed at the University of Melbourne.
Oh, excellent.
And so, obviously, there's some issues with that because there's a lot of people who are against genetically modified foods.
Yes.
But this, obviously, is the best option because it also eliminates the need to spray any insecticides. But who knows what the actual, this is also something new and we need to be more research into BT toxin and see more effects of it if there is any.
That's right. I can imagine 50 years down the track, when the Petri dish is still on the radio, we saying it was a quick fix solution. We started giving BT genes to everything.
50 years of joy on Petri dish. That'd be great. Kane's going to tell us about super bugs that are going to kill us.
That's right. It's our movie time of the week where we discuss a movie and could the science really happen. Starship Troopers, there were giant bugs.
Giant bugs sending meteors to Earth, killing people.
Yes. Yeah, they were. They're enormous bugs. So, well, this week we tried to figure out, could bugs really get to such an enormous size?
So how enormous were they in Starship Troopers?
They were about larger than elephants on this planet.
Whoa.
Some of them were that big. Some of them were the size of horses. So I was looking at how big bugs could get, and at the largest insects were around the same time of the dinosaurs, about 300 million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And at this time, the oxygen concentrations in the atmosphere were at 35% instead of 21% like they are now, which is kind of why they think the dinosaurs got so big themselves, was because there was all this extra oxygen, so it could get perfuse out to their tissues and they could get bigger. So I looked at how much oxygen an insect can actually absorb.
Right.
So I found a study done by an insect physiologist called Alexander Kaiser from Midwest University in Greendale, Arizona. And he was looking at the relationship between the size of beetles and their trachea and the proportional change.
The trachea is in the throat?
The trachea is a part of the lungs and it's in the throat, heads down into the lungs. And the lungs open up and close, sucking in and out air into the lungs. And the trachea on beetles, they have many of them.
Yep.
And they're all over their chest and they absorb air in. It just perfuses across slowly, unlike people who have actual lung systems.
Yeah, sure.
And so what he did is he looked at the size of these, compared them between different sized beetles, and he found that there was a 20% difference from the smallest beetles to the largest beetles, depending on
how much oxygen they took up.
Yeah. And he found that beetles could get up to 6 inches, which is actually the largest size that beetles get to, which is this beetle called the Titanius gigantus, which is in South America.
So 6 inches is the biggest a bug's going to get.
6 inches is on Earth with this amount of oxygen, that's as big as they get. But back 500 million years ago, the dragonflies had a wingspan up to 75 centimeters, which is about the size of a hawk.
Wow.
So
it is possible, but I've heard that, if we had a lot of oxygen, even though we grow faster, it doesn't mean we die faster as well. So these bugs have short lifespans?
No. The idea about lifespan and that, it's not relative to the amount of oxygen that you get in or anything. It depends on genetic clocks that tick away.
Now, we do just have to do a slight correction. The trachea is not in the throat. It's in the chest area.
Yeah, it's the lower part of the chest. Sorry.
But continue, So giant bug. So it's looking like it is possible.
It is possible. So, but to get these bugs that big from that, you need to increase the amount of oxygen that they can get into their lungs. So, or have diffuse across. So you need to increase the amount of oxygen particles in the atmosphere. So you can do that by increasing the percentage of oxygen and by increasing the pressure of the air outside.
Okay.
But it can't just be oxygen-based. Like, if we shoved a whole group of beetles in this oxygen chamber of 50%.
They're not going to grow crazy huge. That, the bit about growing so big is that you need to be genetically set up to that. So you need to be able to evolve to get bigger. And to evolve to get bigger, you need to be allowed to get bigger due to any constraints like food or air or water being available.
So we could create giant bugs.
We could create giant bugs in air, in pressure-controlled containers, lots of oxygen.
But it's not even giant bugs. They also had bigger brains because they could think kind of like humans. Could that happen as well? Could their brain size
get bigger? So in Starship Troopers,
you mean? In Starship Troopers.
The mother alien was this big, giant, like,
psychic
fat blob brain thing that psychic powers that control all the other insects. Could that happen?
Well, I think the idea was that it was like a queen bug and that it could control them all. But bugs generally can work off each other using chemical signals, and that's why it looks like they're using psychic means to control numbers and where they go and what they do. So, but they could grow bigger and bigger brains with more and more oxygen and be able to think like us, think better than we can, be more comprehensive.
I'm not sold.
Ooh, that's a big call, Kane. Under the right conditions.
Are you
going to become a, I don't know, what's the word for an insectologist?
Entomologist.
I don't know the word for it. Sorry. Are you looking to be an entomologist and breed giant superhuman bugs?
The word on Kane's lips is that if we set up oxygen chambers, that we could have bugs that are more intelligent than humans. Can we quote you on that, Kay?
I wouldn't quote me on that. It would take long time.
It's going to be on the podcast. It's okay.
They're misquoting me, people, but it's fine. It happens to everyone.
Anyway, so there we go.
Super ginormous bugs.
That could create war with us on a different planet if oxygen was there and food and some other factors.
The right evolutionary pressures.
And there was
pressures.
Lots of oxygen, lots of air. Now, the scary thing that I found out was if you've got the air pressure up high enough and the air's thick enough, giant bees would be able to fly in that air. So you could even have giant beehives where they're like the size of cows flying around.
Because bees don't really fly, and that's another mystery, science mystery.
No, they kind of swim through the air, and if the air's thick enough, they can be huge and swim through the air.
Okay. Oh,
thank you very much, Kane. So Starship Troopers, maybe
crazy possible.
Maybe if a mad scientist created a giant oxygen chamber with the right conditions, we'll have an alien species.
And
on our
they
hands.
Had maybe a couple of thousand years to evolve while Million humans years. Stayed stagnant.
Well, if we remember evolution, it kind of went really fast.
Or it could be on another planet, and old Darwin over there.
Thank all you right. very much, Kay, for telling us all about it. Next week, we'll be telling you all about voice, how we sing, how we speak at all. And our controversy is whether everyone can learn to be
pitch perfect.
Pitch perfect, exactly.
Now, if you've missed any Petri Dish episodes, you can go to joy.org.au/thePetriDish and you can catch all our old episodes and our blogs.
That's right. And you can get more information on any of the science news that we have and listen up to whatever it is that we were bumbling on about. Did I squeeze one in? One more.
As we do every week. Thanks for listening to the Petri Dish. Today's show is brought to you by the letter I for iodine and the number 53. Have a good night.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.